Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Lenten Rouge Cycling Podcast for our second weekly show, a jam-packed episode this week with the Saudi potential investment in a breakaway cycling league heating up, according to a Reuters exclusive, Red Bull's acquisition of Bora Hansgrohe proceeding for sure as it's passed various legal checks in Austria, as well as race recaps of things going on in Spain, race previews, Visma Lab, Giro teams, a whole host of news. We got a jam-packed show this week, and it's brought to you by Join Cycling, this weekly show. Once again, more on them later. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see I'm back home. I'm happy to be back home. Had a monster week traveling from Brisbane to Doha to Barcelona to Amsterdam, then down into Den Bosch for meetings with Visma Lab, then straight back up, and then across to Barcelona, back home to Andorra yesterday. What are you up to, Benji? Where are you?
Firstly, I'm glad you survived the Netherlands.
Yeah, just
completely flat, very different from your usual environments.
Cold.
Yeah, colder than Australia and Andorra, I think. Andorra is summer now? No, that's
Andorra's
not how that
works. Andorra is technically colder in the morning, but today it was t-shirt weather with sun in the day, so I'll take it here.
Thank you for ignoring that I just said Andorra is summer now in February.
In my house it is.
Okay, I'll accept that. But for me, it's been a hard week when it comes to training, but we'll get back to that by the end. But it's important for me to disclose that I've got a team agreement that I need to disclose. So in the next couple of months, I'll basically be providing performance consultancy towards Lotto Destiny. This is not like a large scale collaboration, but for a few specific races in the next couple of months. So had to disclose that, pretty important. So you know that going into the next couple of podcasts, and this doesn't change anything when it comes to my view on how they ride and so forth. I'm still allowed to shit on them if they do badly and hype them up if they do well. So same story as always, similar as our Jumbo Visma agreement a few years ago. And that's basically it. But outside
of
that,
it might change how I operate.
What, sorry?
Well, if Dali wins Omloop and cleans up the Visma Lab super team, fuck, what
frenemies.
Am I going to... Yeah, it's going to be tough for me to show my face that Sunday afternoon.
We'll see.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that's a good opportunity, Benji. Glad you're
Thank
doing
you.
That. But let's get into some race recaps. We had a Dot Pro stage race this week and two Dot Ones. I would say the strongest race overall was the Alula Tour, which used to be called Saudi Tour, but it's been in the Alula region. Also a very important race for Jayco Alula, as you can tell from their name. I think Jerry was even at the race in person.
Yeah.
They're doing a training camp afterwards. Simon Yates was the favorite for the race. And we basically had a few normal sprints, one crosswind-ish stage, and then a couple of uphill sprints of varying degrees. And then the GC stage is the Sky Views of Hadjerwat, which is like a very unusual stage. 3Ks 13%, followed by a plateau which has crosswinds at over 1,000 meters. Very unusual. You only see that in Tour of Norway, actually.
Yeah.
But usually not that steep. And Van Uden won the first sprint, looking pretty good. I think he's pretty... What is he, 22, 23? He's looking pretty fast.
Yeah, he's very young. We saw him the first time in this Heldeprijs where even I think Welsford did well as well. But I do feel like, looking at the other sprints throughout this week, that he doesn't have the acceleration as much.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know, I don't see him as a top sprinter yet just because he won that first stage of the Alula Tour. But anyway, next stage, Søren Wadenskjold won, which basically was an uphill drag to a sprint. He won that ahead of Henok Mullebrand. Stage 3, a flat sprint basically. We've got Temelier winning ahead of Arvid De Kline. At this point, Groenewegen is basically sick, so he's leaving the race after stage 3.
Not a good day for Luke.
Arvid De Kline losing, yeah.
And
the Tiger.
And
Groenewegen
out, yeah.
But stage four, Metalier winning once again. This was an impressive sprint. He launched with like 400 meters to go.
Impressive, and yeah.
He just won by like a little bit on Brian Coquart.
Impressive, but incredibly stupid. Like the DSM leadout was continuing. There was no pressure from behind anyone jumping. He knows he's the quickest in the last 200. He knows he's the quickest. So there is, like, if he jumps, even if Coquart gets the jump on him from 250, he can still beat him. And he's like, nah, fuck it. Jumps at 320. And I think this is one of the longest sprints, winning sprints in the wind the last 2 years.
Yeah.
From our database,
I think.
Yeah. So Gabriel looks at his 21 seconds and crazy stuff. Coquart thought he won. So it was actually very interesting, or very funny, rather. Stage five was the GC day. Yates attacked early. His last man on the mountain was Mezgetz, so not the best. And then he got countered by William Jr. Le Cerf, who looked very, very good. He was spinning a crazy high cadence on this climb. He and Finn Fisher-Black beat the climbing record on this climb, but they were caught by Yates and co. And Micah, actually. Micah had lost positions on GC due to crosswinds. UAE looked like they might win. They got numbers. Finn, I think, is probably the fastest sprinter on paper in that group. But Yates won. He got the gearing right on the downhill quick sprint. I think Finn was actually in too light a gear in that sprint. And Yates timed it perfectly and won the stage in that many one GC. So they needed that.
Yeah.
Lulan, Jayco needed that for sure.
Yeah, and that's like the one thing that really stands out for me in this race, the importance of the Alula Tour for Jayco to be able to pull that off. It's kind of the UAE Tour for UAE Team Emirates. And I wonder, how much is the value of the Alula Tour compared to like a Tour de France for a team like this? Because Gary Ryan, the way you pronounce it, I don't know, but
Gary.
Before the... Gary, like the snail from SpongeBob. Gary Ryan. Anyway,
yeah, we'll
Gary Ryan, before the stage, said to Simon Yates, apparently this is one of the most important races of our season. This is an important day. And
that's what all the sports psychologists say. The best thing to do before an event is to have the owner go up to the athlete and say, don't fuck it up, buddy. That's the best thing to say, right?
Lefebvre, before every single 1.1 race, he goes to every single Quickstep runner and saying, this is the most important race of your life. Super 8 Classic, the most important race of your life.
It is. I mean, because you can't only control what's happening today. But they did get the job done. They probably would have been hoping for another stage or two. Bessege also happened. Stage 1 cancelled due to farmer protests. There's actually a farmer protest. They blocked Andorra from the French side for quite a while.
Luckily, the entire country.
They blocked access from France to Andorra.
How many roads are into Andorra?
One. One paved.
It's easy.
There's also the Contrabandista roads. So, like, if you look at Sepkoski Strava, he like is always doing the gravel rides in the random smuggling routes in. But they're also blocking the Spanish side on Tuesday. Anyway, stage two is like a 900-meter, 2-minute effort. And Axel Laurence beat Mads Pedersen, which is very, very impressive. The U23 world champion. Pedersen won a flat sprint the next day. Then Samuel Leroux on Van Rysel Roubaix, if I'm not mistaken, gets the first win for a Van Rysel in the pro peloton. And it's not a decathlon rider. It's a Van Rysel Roubaix, which is a French Conti team from like the Lille area in northeast France. He beat Bissiger and De Bont in the break. That's going to be their biggest win for a while.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how long it's been, but I recall it being like 5 to 6 years since they won a race at this level. And to be honest, Van Rijsselroubaix has been a team that's been along for a long while, but to deliver on this level, that's pretty crazy. It was pretty interesting that Magnus Cort wins the sprint behind with Vedaberg really pushing the breakaway beforehand for UNOX, but I don't know if that's a clear tactical mistake because Pedersen was also in the group, so they might not have known that Cort would have won that sprint anyway. But anyway, next stage, we've got Vauquelin winning the TT. This is the final stage ahead of Pedersen, but it would depend on the actual seconds that Vauquelin is ahead of Pedersen who wins GC. And Pedersen ends up winning GC because he had enough time going into this time trial. Really good time trial of Vauquelin, to be honest.
Really
but,
good.
Pedersen rode in his own skin suit. And I remember that in Bessège in the past, That's happened before, no? I don't know which year, so. But...
Because hey. In the Tour, you can't do that. I mean, listen, probably if they want Pedersen, a former world champion, to come, it's a 2.1 race, let's remember.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he can wear his own skin suit. I think they'd rather he won the race overall than they forced him to wear the skin suit, would be my guess. So he wins by 2 seconds. That vocal on TT, you got to say, given that there's flat at the start, is he was 2 seconds slower than Ganna's record on this. So yeah. I think he must have absolutely nuked the climb. And this guy's 5-minute power is really, really good. And
he was flying.
I'm not sure he's going to turn into who they think he's going to turn into. I think he's a different rider, but that doesn't mean he's not a special rider. I think he's a really special rider.
Who do you think they think they he will turn into, and who do you think you
Come
will...
on.
Jesus, this sentence. You know what I mean.
He's French and he climbs.
Okay. The next Tour de France winner.
Oh, no, I'm being disingenuous. That's being unfair. I think they probably will be focusing on him becoming a GC rider rather than someone who can win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And I would say right now, he looks like someone who can podium Liège-Bastogne-Liège if he can improve some endurance. We've only really seen it in easy races so far, but it's, yeah, very, very impressive. Pedersen, though, wins GC. I think he missed out on it before. Valenciana finished today. This race perhaps definitely not as interesting as it was 2 years ago when Vlasov was leaving Remco in the literal dust on a 20-minute climb, and they had a brilliant start, Luis-Enric Mas, Valverde. Here, the GC favourites were McNulty and Vlasov, like in Mallorca. Stage one, Bardiani did a Trofeo Baracchi in the breakaway and took a GC lead, but they actually lost 25 or so seconds because of a wrong turn. And Tonelli's not a bad rider he's not a guy who just insta-drop. The next day, Moritz attacked on the descent. He had attacked on the descent the day before. Vlasov entered the descent second wheel, and I think he just can't hold the wheel. And once Moritz is gone, he's gone. So, strange anyway. Stage three, Milan won the bunch sprint. He literally was the best sprinter here by heads and shoulders above everybody else, although it was funny to see Consonni leading him out. Stage four, Benji. McNulty got his tactics right. He's messed up a few times. He hit him on the misery climb. He hit Buitrago just when he and Vlasov were messing about and Buitrago was on the radio over the crest.
Exactly. A strong stage right with McNulty, because on paper you'd say Vlasov should be able to compete with him and so forth on this parcours. The race was shortened. Supposedly was supposed to end on the Val de Beau climb, but they ended it basically 20-ish K earlier on the Alto del Miserat, the misery climb, like you mentioned, because unfortunately a driver of the Ilias, I don't know the second part of that name of the team, a driver of that team passed away, unfortunately, at the finish line, so that's why they chose to finish the stage early. But what also shocked me after the stage is that Tonelli was still fourth in GC.
Yeah.
Crazy, right?
Exactly. Like, he's not a bad rider. And Bardiani are cooking this year. You got to watch out for Bardiani. They're winning a Giro stage this year if they get their tactics right. They got good riders. Yeah, Pellizzari's actually good. He's rumored to go to Bora. More on them later. Last stage, Will Bardo won a fantastic breakaway win. It wasn't as good as last year either, where there was chaos on the last stage and Ruby Costa won. And Ter Gegenhardt did 8 watts per kilo for 15 minutes. It was, basically a breakaway. He dropped everyone on 50Ks from the finish, and he's a good time trial. So we've seen that with a second in a Vuelta TT before behind Roglic, and he takes his first pro win with Trek unable to chase him down when Milan should have gone at 1K to go pursuit style. Because when he opened up the taps for the sprint, when he opened up the taps, he put 10 bike lengths into everyone without trying. He would have won if he went at 1K to go.
I fully agree. It's the first thought I had at the finish line that he should have done the Bemerse Classic Spedersen move, and he wouldn't win this. Won the stage. But
no one would have held his
wheel. I'm much, much happier that Will Barta took this stage. First pro victory, not necessarily a rider that is likely to win many things in the future again, but to see him win this, to see Lascano in the peloton, also playing around a bit, I enjoyed that, and I enjoy Will Barta winning. I enjoy seeing Tonelli win on stage one. So the breakaway wins really were the standout for me in this race.
That's the race reviews. Decent racing. maybe not the strongest start list. A lot of the big guns are holding their cards close to their chest until the ones coming up, like Andalusia. Normally, Valenciano in the past had a bit of a stronger start list. But before we get into the previews of the races coming up, a word on our show partner for today's episode, Join Cycling, where you can get the most out of your power meter or your heart rate meter monitor for training by using the Join Cycling training app with true adaptive training plans that adapt to your training history and progress. But most importantly, and particularly for me, this literally, the recovery plan that I've finished a week ago on Join Cycling is the first plan I've just about ever completed, like cycling plan. Like, I am as someone who probably knows above average about power, training thresholds, zones, I'm subject to the same like foibles as everybody else, where I just end up riding around junk all the time with no structure whatsoever. And that plan I completed was the first time I'd able to complete a month-long plan just about ever. And I found the guideposts of the Join Cycling app really useful for that. And the plan actually made a lot of sense to me. And so, upcoming, you can also, if you have an event, either a one-day event or a classics event, I'm tossing and turning which one to choose, which plan, either the one-day plan or the classics plan for our Attack of the Flandrian challenge in March. You put in the date, you put in the meters of climbing for your event, you put in how long it is, and it generates a plan that's catered to that event. And if you want to try it out yourself, the Join Cycling app, Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast listeners can benefit from a 30-day free trial period, absolutely risk-free. You don't even have to give your credit card details. Just download the app and then use the URL supplied below or scan the QR code and get 30 days of free training with Join Cycling. So don't take my word for it. Try it out for 30 days and I'm sure you will like it and see good results. So thanks to Join Cycling for supporting the podcast and this weekly show. We're still in the desert, Benji. The UAE Tour Women kicks off this week with the same stages as last year, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, basically three flat stages and one stage of Jebel Hafid on day three. So that's what we're looking at. The start list is pretty bare bones for now. We only have Little Trek with a confirmed start list, including Realini and Longo Borghini. So those are the first two of last year, so happy that they're back. Let's hope Arialini is the full-on leader this time, hopefully. Let's see what happens in the echelons, though. I'm honestly just looking forward to Wibis and Cole if they arrive for the sprints. That's the one thing I'm looking forward to, plus Jebel Hafid as well, so I'm kind of hyped for this one, but we've got some other races on the menu as well this week, right?
We do, and I want to see Arialini cooking on that parkour. Free Arialini, unleash the beast. I want to see Le Cerf lay down a gauntlet for small diminutive climbers in the desert. I need to see Realini go on better and win the stage for them. Tour Colombia is back. We really wanted to talk about this because this is a fantastic race that has been away for a while and is back. And if you remember some of the original videos I made, it always gets the most stacked start list, which I think, you know, credit to Colombia, because you look at the Tour Down Under, it doesn't get the best Australian cyclists there every year going back for it. And this year, it's got Bernal, Carapaz not Colombian, but South American, Rivera, who else is doing it? Uran. Yeah, it's like Quintana, Gaviria, Cavendish is a strange one, Tejada. You look at the EF team, and it's like... It looks like a Giro winning team.
Are you telling me you've mentioned all these climbers and all these sprinters and so forth, but you forgot the legend himself, Oscar Sevilla, at the age of 79? That's what I'm guessing, at least is his age at this point.
There's also the Estonian team there, kind of standing out like a sore thumb amongst the South Americans, as well as Coratec being there. Watch out, though, this is very deep in the weeds. Watch out for Jonathan Caicedo. He was on EF as well as his team at Camargo, but watch out for Caicedo. He's on Petrolike. We like petrol. It's a Mexican Conti team, if I'm not mistaken. And
Camargo too?
Yeah. And he just won a race. He won some Vuelta Altachira.
Yeah,
he just won that. So just it'd be funny if he beat the EF guys. But anyway.
Mate, Sergio Henao was at this race.
What the hell? It's going to be great.
For New Colombia.
New Colombia?
Sounds like a political party.
Yeah, Janssen Pantano's the DS. It's always a like crazy race with sometimes two crazy spectators, but the fans absolutely love it and get around it. All the stages are, as you know, predicted at about 1,000,000 meters altitude. So even if it's like a 3K 6% finish, it's so high up that it ends up being just really, really hard. The main mountain stage is the Alto del Vino. Maybe it's 30.2Ks at 6%. So a really, really long climb. We're going to see Quintana and co. It's a great gradient because it's drafting matters, teammates matter, and tactics matter, but it's also hard because it's at such high altitude. So I'm looking forward to watching that. It appears to have 10 leaders jerseys. I don't know if they're actually all worn in the race because Luke said that only 4 leaders jerseys are allowed, but they have, I'll read them all out. Leader of the race, of course. Points leader, okay. Mountain leader, young rider. All right, that's the 4 normal ones. Sprint especial, don't know what that is. Stage winner, best Colombian, best foreigner, best teammate, and favorite of the fans. 6 other jerseys. They
this
must
is
just
be a
awards.
Color book. I don't know, man. Like. If we look at the Giro, for example, they have like the jerseys in the race, but they also have the classifications outside of the race. They are presenting this as 10 jerseys based on the graphics I'm looking at. So I'm expecting 10 jerseys, 10 distinctive jerseys in the race. And if I won't have them, I'll be heavily disappointed because that's pretty epic. Like the Mejor Colombiano is probably... Nah, not probably, is potentially going to be won by the leader of the general classification, which means it might be, it's going to be every lead, like for example, if Carapaz, if Bernal is first or something, Carapaz second, then another Colombian in third, if Uran is that third rider, Uran's going to wear that jersey while Carapaz will wear the foreign jersey, while Bernal will win the leader of the general jersey, you'll have 3 riders with different jerseys in the top 3.
Well, I think what they've done, yeah, because to that point, this basically means they can get all of the big stars on the podium every day.
Yeah.
Because the race leader is going to be one of the big stars. And then if Carapaz wins, then that means there's still the best Colombian jersey available to like Bernal or someone. And then you've got like favorite of the fans. That's going to be the leftover. That's going to be Quintana if he's not in the leader's jersey. So
Uran, I'm telling you.
Oh yeah, this is the first. This is the test of Uran versus Quintana popularity. We'll see. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that race. How I'll watch it, no idea. But I'm sure probably on YouTube somewhere. Probably the race with the strongest start list coming up this week, I would say, is the Figuera Champions Classic, which is about. It's 220Ks long and has a start list that looks like Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Yeah.
Has a length just about that long and a parkour about that long. This is the race to watch this week with Remco Almeida. Remco's got a strong team. Bagioli, who came second in Lombardia, now at Little Trek. A strong EF team. This is the race I've got penciled down to watch this week.
Yeah, same thing. And looking at the way this has grown, this race, last year 1.1 race, now 1.pro race, only existed for the last 2 years now. 2023 was the first edition, if I recall correctly. And the start list is just major, like you mentioned all the names, and it's also got a parkour that can create different scenarios. And I don't know, I'm looking forward to see all the riders that we haven't seen this year, like at Remco, start their season here. So this should be good. I'm definitely going to watch it. We've got 2 more races that are starting this week outside of some Spanish 1.1s. Oh, okay. I'm holding on.
a Glass Drive doing this?
They're a different team now, right? Subgoal?
Is that what their name is?
Yeah, I'm not certain.
Yeah, yes. They're called Subgoal Anikola. And why don't they have their good rider doing it? Moreira.
Good question. Maybe he's still in Southern America at the moment.
Yeah. Anyway,
he came last year and DNF'd, so.
Okay. Fair
maybe
enough.
He doesn't want to come anymore.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. Other race, Tour de la Provence returns, but unfortunately, I think it's a lower category. It's 2.1. The start list is weaker. There's less World Tour teams, and it doesn't have a mountaintop finish. This is normally where we would see Quintana go nuclear on Chalet Renard, which is like two-thirds of the way at Mont Ventoux or Montagne de Lure. They don't have that in this race, although they do have a couple of nice stages for the young, talented French rider. Axel Zangler, although I'm not sure he's doing it because he might be going to Oman. We'll have to see. I think he is doing Provence, but because they've got that Manosque finish where Ganna was good against Alaphilippe, that really suits him. But this, I don't know. But Bessege and this Benji are both missing something a bit like a proper 12-minute, 15-minute climb, in my opinion.
I reckon I agree. It's kind of, I wonder. Tour du Haut Var kind of stage in Provence.
Yes.
The kind of Molar versus whatever stages, those type of stages I need. Maybe, I feel like Provence has those climbs, so they should probably be able to do that. But that doesn't mean that these stages aren't going to be interesting. Like, Manosque was Coquart as well last year, if I recall correctly, so he's not on the provisional start list.
He's in the middle list.
Yeah, true. But yeah, I'm also... Provence has dropped down a little in my list of races in February. There's other races that are more intriguing, and talking about that, Oman's going to be a bit more intriguing for me personally because I feel like there's one flat stage and three Muro finishes and one medium mountain finish. Is that a correct classification, you reckon?
Yeah, there's like those Alcoriat and Yitty Hill stages are quite hard. I think Ulisi or Herrada won one last year, and then Herrada backed that up in the Vuelta. And then, Green Mountain is brutal. Like, that's where Van Sevenon and Jorgensen did very, very big numbers last year because they basically walk up to the base of this brutally steep climb, which has had the greats on it. It's had, I think, Spilak or Froome, Purito, and Van Sevenon, I believe, will be back. This race starts later in the week, so we don't have confirmed start list yet. But I will be keen to see, if Merlier continues here, because he obviously did Saudi, or whether
that's
they bring
him only.
Yeah, maybe he's gone back, and maybe they want Mag. Because if Magnier, if he can get around some of these, the rolling stages, he is going to be tough to beat by anybody else on this start list. I think he's probably quicker than Coquart, just about.
I think it's a mistake that Astana might be sending Lutsenko to Tour Colombia instead of Tour of Oman, because these stages shout Lutsenko for me.
Yeah, but then on Green Mountain, he just gets ruined, but then who's going to ruin him, you know? I think... I'm surprised Van Aertveldt's not going if he's not doing this race, to be honest. Like... I would have sent Van Aertveldt to win this, given how he...
I reckon so as well.
Yeah, like, I really don't see anyone going... First of all, he's really punchy, so he could maybe take some bonies on the other stages. And secondly, I think he just straight up win the Green Mountain stage. So I would have expected him to be at the start, but it, as I said, it's quite a way in the future. That is the previews of the races this week. So we've got a fair few on. And then the week after, the really big ones start, like Algarve, Andalusia, Clásica Jaén, and Gran Camino is a bit later. So, but these are, some nice races, particularly UAE Tour women. Other news, Benji. On to other news. The big one this week, I would say probably the biggest news is the non-announcement or the non contest of anybody in the Austrian competition court that Red Bull could acquire a controlling interest in the Bora Hansgrohe parent company. Basically, a controlling interest in the Bora Hansgrohe cycling team. They own it now or shortly in the future. Kind of like Bora, they did a press release saying it's happening, but there's no real deep, like it's a two-liner just about. And there's no real details on what it's going to look like yet, unless I'm mistaken.
I feel like the initial rumors of it came out on Twitter when I think Ike Spun on Twitter posted that they found on the internet the page on like the FCA, the Austrian Competition Authority, that the acquisition was like applied for. And then Bora responded to that with like, oh, we can't really say anything about it because it's still being handled by the authorities. And then when it did, they said, we've got the green light, but we'll talk more about it in the future. And those words were exactly the following: we'll present further details of our partnership in the course of the season. So it wouldn't shock me if it's like announced surrounding or just before the Tour de France or something, that area when the hype in the season is bigger than early part here. But it's also something that is when that has gone into like steps here, because this doesn't come out of nowhere. Red Bull's been in the Bora environment for quite a bit, as in they sponsored the Bora Hansgrohe junior scouting program. That program is called Red Bull Junior Brothers. And I think two of their riders went to the U23 team that they work with, which was Team Auto Eder Bayer, if they are still doing that. I'm not 100% certain, because they are also working with a few other teams now. But in addition to that, Red Bull's got many cyclists in this sport. Wout van Aert, Pidcock wearing Red Bull helmets. Zoë Bakstedt on the women's side. Anton Palzer, who is riding for Bora. Those are the two, like, previously. That's what happened. But now with that controlling interest, there's so many questions. Because on one end, a lot of people were rumoring. And as a consequence, there were literally articles coming out based on just the thought of the fact that there's people riding around in Red Bull helmets. And then Red Bull being invested in Bora Hansgrohe with 51% in the future with a stake in that. I don't think this will have any consequence towards Wout van Aert or Pidcock transferring over to Bora Hansgrohe or something just because they wear a Bora helmet, a Red Bull helmet. I don't see that.
No. Although it does mean the team has more money.
Yeah.
So it's possible they can get riders of that caliber more realistically and often because they have more money. Rather than, oh, hey, you're now also sponsored by, owned by Red Bull. Let me just change teams mid-contract. Like, Pidcock and van Aert are under contract. I feel like the Pidcock-Red Bull collaboration is much more significant than the van Aert one. Don't you reckon, like, Pidcock, is it because Pidcock does, like, the mountain bike stuff more and van Aert is really pretty much road-focused now?
I think so, but I'm not sure if that's particularly a bigger agreement for that sense. That might just be because Pidcock does slightly crazier stuff, because we still remember that Wout van Aert went across the line with his wings flapping about in the yellow jersey in Calais 2 years ago. So that's still the case, but I agree. There's definitely more money. I think there's also other consequences to this, and we're going to know more of that in the future, but the merger is classified under economic sectors, other sports activities, and creation of advertising campaigns. And at the last spot, I'm like wondering, is that related to advertising on the Bora Hansgrohe shirt as a consequence? Or is that more related to the fact that they've got this whole media business, Red Bull? They've got an award-winning media house that creates content with their athletes, that creates content in general. I think there's some kind of Red Bull TV kind of thing. I just expect better team content, better sponsorship activations, better PR stuff. Like, if Red Bull was in the team when Roglic was announced, it would have been handled differently in my head.
Yeah, of course. Like, Bora had the Netflix producers follow them around for season one, and then they got cut out of the show because it's too boring. So, like,
Jesus.
Well, I mean, it was. It was. That's what happened. Or they couldn't find a storyline that was intriguing, is another, if you want to put it that way. So, obviously, Red Bull, they're here to make, they're a marketing company. So, that's been said a million times. So, I'm sure they will want to boost that part of the team. And they probably see a nice canvas to do so with a team that's, yeah, progressed well. It's won a Grand Tour recently, and it's got good riders, yep. And it's doing well at attracting good riders to come to that team, and it's got good equipment. So maybe they think, well, we can come in. Also, you know, they're Austrian, and so everyone's, they're all German speakers in management, presumably. So maybe they can come in and really boost that part of the team. They see an opportunity there. But otherwise, I don't know when it's drinking. Pre-tour, they change team name and change it all? Change the jersey?
Change team name is difficult, eh? Because what happens to the existing agreements?
Yeah, Bora Hansgrohe got contracts.
Yeah, they've got contracts to be in the name sponsor, stuff like that. To add Red Bull to that kind of reduces
Didn't one just extend?
What, sorry?
One just extended, too.
So, yeah, that makes me wonder whether they already knew about that situation going on, or whether that will impact the value of their sponsorships in the future. It's so many questions behind the scenes, but that's something they can deal with. there's also feedback on this. Like, people shout sports washing, but I'll be honest. Yeah, of course, there's some sports washing, but they're an unhealthy brand. Sports drink being sports washed in sports. That's how I perceive those comments, but they're so much worse in this sport than Red Bull joining, in my opinion. Like, if we're gonna, on the scale of sports washing and cycling, this is on the lowest end.
I'm not even sure that counts. It's just like marketing a product.
It's
that,
like,
yeah,
Burger King sponsoring on the butt of Aolo.
That didn't last for that long, did it?
But it was funny.
It was funny. I mean, I noticed it. Yeah, listen, if Red Bull can't buy a team and sponsor a team, then...
Wait. Good luck. Question. So, when Fortunato won, or when someone of Aolo won a stage, Contador was celebrating, right? In his video after the stage?
Yeah, yeah.
I have rewritten that history in my head that he was eating a burger in that video. Is that wrong or right?
I think you're hallucinating.
See, the Burger King ad has done something to my head.
Well... What's Aolo? What does that company do?
I only know that they sponsored the Giro, and for the rest, I don't know. Electrical company?
What's Cometa do?
Absolutely no clue. What does Bolti do?
Is that Hungarian food? Like,
I don't
meat.
Fucking know.
One of them's something to do with Hungary and meat. That's why they sound fed up.
Come eat?
See, like, at least Red Bull, you know what it is. Decathlon, you know what it is. Lidl, you know what it is. What's Burger King? You know what it is. So I would say you've got global ambitions. It makes more sense. Yeah, I'm keen to see what happens here. I think it's a good sign for the sport overall, yeah. Because I honestly, and this is going to go into our next topic maybe, but I honestly hear all the time, cycling's dying, cycling needs to change. And like, yeah, it is annoying as hell that I can't see half the races in February, and that needs to be fixed. But that is, I think, should be easily fixed with some people getting their heads together. But like, is what World Tour team folded last year? It didn't.
Lots of them are on the...
Look at these Pro Conti teams coming with more money. Tudor, Q365.
I do feel like, and maybe that's just a part of the sport, that there's always someone on the brink. Teams are,
yeah, because they pay riders too much.
Well, they also have to if the competition keeps spending more and more.
Yeah, I know, but like, if you compare what cyclists get paid, like the top 20 cyclists to the top 20 rugby players and the Rugby World Cup, I'm sorry, which is a bigger event than I've. It's a big event and eclipse cycling.
Not bigger than the Tour de France.
I don't know about that.
Maybe it's a perspective from which country you're from, but from my Belgian perspective,
in France,
I've never even seen a rugby match in my life.
Yeah, but
it's probably not in the top 10 sports in Belgium.
People in Wyoming haven't seen a Tour de France in their life either.
Wow.
They certainly haven't seen a Danilif Nigirakorsa. Yeah, but they probably also didn't watch the rugby. But my point is, like, the top 20 cyclists get paid better than top 20 rugby players by a fair way. And so I'm like, well, if the salaries are pretty healthy and have grown a lot in the last 10 years, a lot, then is the sport really in such dire? Because I swear I see an article every week that, like, the sport is on the brink of collapse.
How important is the best rugby player in a team compared to the best cyclist
yeah,
in
true.
A team?
Yeah, true. It's like you can have the best, like Brian Lara on the Windies team, or, yeah, good luck with that reference. Or, yeah, like the French scrum half, I don't know what he's on, or the best New Zealand, I think, best New Zealand player might be on a million. And they're one of 15, and they can't impact the game the same amount as a basketball player like LeBron or Curry in one in five.
Pogacar.
Or basically one of one sometimes in cycling. So I take your point. But I'd like to still compare the 100th ranked rider on PCS to the 100th ranked rugby player. I think it'd be interesting if we knew the salaries of both. So I don't. Yeah, obviously, if you compare it to football, they're not getting paid as well. I'm not saying they should be paid less either. It's not what I'm saying. Very dangerous sport. Riders can die or be permanently injured, and they train, I would say, harder than athletes in those sports that I've mentioned as well. But salaries have gone up. So, like, where's the money coming from if the sport is on the brink, as I said, which segues us, Benji, into...
Wait, I think my final comment is that I do think an impact to that is that the teams that are not on the brink are the ones that are continuously causing the salary to go up, while the teams that are on the brink are continuously trying to have more money to try and still struggle because the bigger teams have made the average higher, if that makes sense. But that's just my last remark.
Right, so I take your point. So Ineos, Bora, UAE, Visma. I'll put Quickstep in there too. They basically pay five to seven riders each, which is about 30 riders, and that just blows salaries out. And there's the other teams just cannot compete for those top 30 riders on salary, and there's just a completely different salary house between the teams. I can see that. If Intermarché had Vingegaard and he wins the tour, they either somehow get it to keep him, they either somehow get a new sponsor to pay his whole his salary to match whatever offers he would have gotten, or then he would just go as soon as the contract.
They couldn't even afford Costa.
Yeah, well, let's not compare 38-year-old Costa to...
yeah, but the fact that they couldn't financially keep him for the salary that he's probably worth, I don't know.
But then I also think, like, if you're EF, why are you paying Rui Costa?
Yeah, I agree.
Like, what is that doing for you?
Reminds me of the Iking transfer.
Worse. He'd be paid, he's former world champion, Benji. He'd be getting paid more than Christian
financially.
Iking.
I agree.
Yeah. Anyway, I agree. It's not so clear. There is an inequality amongst the rich teams. And if there was revenue sharing, which is, then that would filter down and then they wouldn't be able to. But yeah, just my point. I was just a devil's advocate pushing back that it's all doom and gloom all the time. But
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Get
Speaking of things that might change, one of the big news this week in terms of changing the sport was the Reuters exclusive. This is their second exclusive. They seem to be getting the leaks or the news on this. Their headline is Saudi Arabia closes in on deal to create new cycling league, hyphen sources. Now that's you, but they're not very clear. I'm not saying they should name their sources, but they don't even really name like where those sources come from. Like whether they're from a team, from PIF. Anyway, the potential investor is an investment firm, according to them, owned by Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, PIF. So yeah, essentially Saudi Arabia's public money, called SRJ Sports Investments, which was, they basically created as a subsidiary of that investment fund to focus on sports. So it's going to be specialized in investing in sports. And the potential investment is supposed to be 250 million euros, which, what is that number? When you hear that number, what do you think, Benji?
I think that's not that much.
Yeah, exactly. I agree, right?
Like, to be clear, I'm not earning 240 million. I will never in my life earn close to that amount. But
never say never.
I severely doubt it.
Podcasting, who knows what could happen?
I don't know, man. But I will say, if we take a look at, first of all, the cost that teams have right now when it comes to budgets, if you put the budgets of all teams together, you already got an amount that is larger than that, I reckon, or close to that, or roughly
World
around
Tour
that.
Teams?
World Tour teams.
What was the average it came out? Like 25 mil, 28, 27 mil?
Yeah, 25 to 28 mil. So that times 18 is higher than 240, if my basic maths is correct.
Yep, that number's right there, yep.
But it's not necessarily, that's not necessarily the equation that we need to make. It's how much is it going to cost to set up the system that they want to set up, which is basically a breakaway league?
Oh, zero.
The cost to set that up.
Yeah, you just do crits around track and Riyadh.
I fear that it's going to be more than just zero crits around Apeldoorn or something. Luke will be happy around the area.
But no, I agree to your point. Like, it actually is not as much money as I thought. Now, I don't know what the, because like the fund for the LIV, because we're always comparing this. This is like to LIV. So LIV Golf, they wanted to get a seat at the table with the PGA. And so they got this huge pool of money and they basically bought up big golfers. And then the PGA said, if you go to LIV, you can't do the Masters. You can do the Masters. You can't play PGA events. And they were getting guys on 100 milli contracts, and they're getting multiple guys. So like that pool was way bigger. Eventually, the PGA, after saying you'd be banned, a year or so later, caved in despicable fashion and merged with LIV. So they basically just folded after the Saudis burned cash.
Question number one. You're saying that in LIV Golf, they basically paid for golf players to play in their league.
Yeah, playing in
cycling,
Mickey Mouse League, yeah.
The teams are part of setting up this project, so I would guess that you're not necessarily directly paying them. Aren't they just getting a share of the revenue in the idea of the setup?
Well, this is where it gets tricky. So we're going to deep dive into this. So this article, so Richard Plucker gave an interview with someone, I want to, Luke will look it up. He didn't exclude, Radio Cycling, in the last month. And he spoke about the One Cycling project, and that sounded like a broader, all stakeholders involved, or at least that's what he seemed to want with ASO, RCS, the relevant stakeholders. This article is saying it's eight teams, no ASO, no RCS, don't know about Flanders Classics. And I very much doubt the UCI is involved in this. So what does that mean?
Yeah.
What would happen? Get this pool of funds, 250 mil, eight teams. Still don't know if that's worth it because that's only like 30 mil a team. And that's probably the teams we're talking about are Ineos and Visma. So it's not the lower budget teams. But let's keep working with the hypothetical. They go over. The UCI says you're banned from World Tour events because you joined this breakaway league. Step number one. Now, Brunil said in his pod on the move that he analyzed the European Court of Justice or whatever decision that said that's anti-competitive, which it is, because that got struck down when another sports federation tried to do that or pull that sort of stuff. Anyway, UCI probably would do that. And then the riders, now that their World Tour team, so their World Tour team has now had its World Tour license cancelled because the UCI just said, fuck you. The riders can now terminate their contracts with the World Tour team because a condition in the model contract, which you can't contract out of, is that when a World Tour team contracts with you, if they lose their World Tour status, you can terminate your contract, which no one did when Israel and Lotto got relegated. So that just makes this really complicated because if you're Vingegaard, Benji, let's say you're Vingegaard, you're probably already getting paid pretty well. You want to do the Tour de France. Your team decides it wants to do this new league. And then it goes and does that. You don't want to do it. The team's getting the money or getting paid because it has Jonas Vingegaard. And then the UCI, you can then cancel your contract and then sign with one of the teams that hasn't gone to the breakaway league. So it's really difficult. It's not like with golf, with privateers.
Yeah. It's a very complex system. And you're right about the European Court of Justice thing. I'm pretty sure that was about the Super League in football.
Yes.
It was initially
basically said it was play
aside.
On.
Yeah, and then it was decided play on, and then I think the sports management company behind it said that it would be trying to relaunch the competition late 2022 as a consequence of that European Court of Justice decision to basically a ban on people that compete in the other league to compete in yours that was uncompetitive and so forth. So, but there's just so many aspects to this, and there's been so many rumors like this in the past where, from a basic perspective, as someone that's been following cycling for the last, 15, 17 years, something like that, gradually increasing, obviously. And when I was 10, I wasn't a hardcore cycling fan yet. But throughout that period, you get used to this calendar that we have. You get used to the system that we have at the moment in our heads as somewhat traditional cycling fans, because most cycling fans are like, ooh, we like how it's working right now. It's going to be like, ooh, this is a change. This is scary. Because what will this do to the setup we are currently having? We've got the Tour de France, Giro, LBL, Flèche Wallonne, all these ASO and RCS races. How will this extra calendar next to that impact those races? Will ASO at any point even remotely be annoyed by that breakaway league existing outside of that, which will basically be a racing league outside of those currently existing big races, is how I perceive it. And when I look at that, I'm thinking, why would a rider be interested in a top rider be interested in riding that league if it comes at the cost of the other races? So
they got to be getting paid. They got to be getting paid 3-4x.
Yeah, that's where the 240 million is going, man.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem enough because they spent 100 mil to acquire a minority stake in the United States Professional Fighters League, which I didn't know what that is. That ain't the UFC, by the way. It's some I like MMA and boxing, but PFL is not the biggest thing, and they only got 2.5, 2.7x more money for a cycling league with the best riders in the world for a much, much bigger sport. MMA, UFC, let's say, is, you know, more profitable, more revenue, but the PFL certainly doesn't. So I don't see those numbers adding up.
Is that not the thing where Jake Paul is like promoting PFL? I think he's trying to get extra fighters in that or something relative to the other. But yeah, I agree to your point, but it's like, it's like there's still so many questions unanswered. And yeah, also, if you take a look at the Reuters article, only eight teams are involved without ASO RCS. Documents expected to be signed in the next 2 months. But then on the other end, it's saying sources say there's nothing concrete yet and talks are still ongoing. And I'm like, you can't have both. They aren't going to solve these questions in 2 months, I reckon. So I don't know, man.
That's what I see the title of the article. But, and then I read like the first two paragraphs. I'm like, holy fuck, is this happening next month?
Like, yeah, is this not?
And then you scroll down, you're like, oh, it's not progressed at all since the previous exclusive article. It sounds like CVC partners just might not have bid, because it depends how you look at it. Like, yeah, whether the Saudi subsidiary won a competitive auction or was the only bidder, I don't know. That's unclear. It's written like they won a competitive auction, but you also compare. So the end game would be, if you think the end game's the same as in golf, where they acquire a stake in the PGA, then the end game is to get on a stake in ASO, right? And RCS.
But I don't have the feeling that ASO will ever be okay with having... It's like a super family-built company. And
they said that recently in public.
Doing good.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in addition to that, if you look at the situation, outside of the investment from PIF, the setup of this is starting to look a lot like the Hammer series was. As in, races outside of the current calendar, held by a third party that is not in the sport yet necessarily, where the teams have a say in.
Yeah. It just depends. So like, if the league can go side by side with the UCI calendar and the UCI don't or can't blacklist you, then the money kind of makes sense, because you can essentially, that's just bonus prize money then.
Yeah, but
and they can still do the tour and everything.
That's the problem with the leak as well. The thought behind it is that you then have the best riders at the best races. No, the biggest riders at the same races in that league is the view that comes out, with not overlapping races, but you're destined to overlap with the existing calendar if it's in addition to the already current existing races. If ASO and RCS are not involved, then all these tiny organizers, the organizers that are organizing the Giro del Veneto, the Italian classics, the 1.1 Belgian ChatGPT races, like all those other races will still be happening. And I just don't... I would like to see something like this in action for 1 year just to see what it's like.
Oh, yeah, give us a lot to talk about. But what could happen is everyone just does the tour and the big, big races.
Yeah.
And then they spend the rest of the season earning much bigger prize money in a separate calendar.
Also a question. With all these Middle Eastern races that exist, like UAE Tour, like Sharjah Tour, like Oman, like Saudi Tour, I don't know what the relation is between those countries, to the point that will UAE be happy with the situation that a Saudi-backed One Cycling is starting, or will they start... Is there a fight between Middle Eastern countries in sports? As in, is there a fight between hosting a UAE Tour, hosting an Oman, hosting a Saudi Tour, to the point that we might then see other Middle Eastern countries with money showing up and saying, oh, we want to host something like that as well?
I mean, maybe they join I'm not sure. They were entitled to join this tender, it seems like, and they didn't. So it's no secret that this has been happening. But yeah, I just on ASO, by the way, there's a sticky bottle article on this with their revenues from previous years.
Yeah.
And before the Netflix series was released, according to this article, their revenue jumped 17% to $550 million a year. And that's before the Netflix series.
And after? And do we know that?
We don't know that yet.
Okay.
And we also don't know the split. That's not just from the tour, by the way. That's from all their activities. They organized Dakar Rally, Paris Marathon. But the cycling is at least half, part, I would say, of that. So... They are, and they also said, an ASO spokesperson told Bloomberg, the group is an independent family-owned company. We intend to remain independent in order to develop our activities with a long-term vision. You also have to bear in mind that the reason, and this goes to the Tour of Britain, so we'll cover two birds with one stone. The Tour of Britain, this is not recent news. Tour of Britain organizer Sweet Spot has declared bankruptcy or is going into liquidation, which is very unfortunate. And the race is in jeopardy. British Cycling says they'd like it to continue. Ineos want to try to help that happen. We'll see if that does happen. I have my doubts. One of the biggest problems for them and the biggest inherent benefits for ASO and the Tour is, and in Spain, the cost of organizing is so much lower. Are you going to get all those police, I don't know, at cost or free, all those road closures, all of that, for that price or lack of price, if you're suddenly co-owned or partially owned or majority controlled by the Saudi, by PIF?
If you're ASO? Example.
No, ASO. So if ASO sell 51% to PIF...
They won't do that.
But if they did, then like surely that all of a sudden, here's the invoice for how much the police cost if you want to run your race around France for 3 weeks, is how I imagine it would go. Like, it's a quid pro quo at the moment because a friend is a family-owned French company.
But if we go back to the original problems of this entire thing that started this breakaway league idea, like the teams wanting a share of the revenue from the races, like teams want the share from the revenue of the Tour de France. My question, Dennis, because I don't exactly know the history, has there ever been an attempt by teams to boycott the Tour de France itself? Which, I know as cycling fans, we don't want to see it, but from a team's perspective...
You can't. How do you tell your sponsor you're going to boycott the Tour?
Yeah. It's fucked, eh?
Yeah, they'll be like, all right, we'll terminate our contract with you today and good luck paying your riders.
How is your team going to like that you're doing this one cycling thing then that might impact your race schedule outside of that?
Well, that's where the 250 million, we'll go back to that. That's where it doesn't make sense because you would need to essentially bankroll the fact or the guarantee the risk that they get held out of the Tour, existing sponsors bail, and you now have to backstop and guarantee the existing contracts for all those riders, and it has to be more. Because they're not doing it to break even, so that's where the 250. I don't know. We obviously don't know what's going on, so maybe it does make sense.
Speculation.
But I've enjoyed discussing it, and certainly as I've discussed it, I've realized that in this team environment, it is very, very difficult. The way cycling's set up, it is than with golf. So
and it's pretty toxic environment. But then again, that's probably the case in every sport.
I mean, yeah, that's just sports, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I already mentioned Tour of Britain, but we'll see if that happens this year. It's still on the UCI calendar. It's in a better spot, I think, this year. But as I said, the cost of organizing those events, it's not apples and apples between different countries. Like, there's a reason Tour of California doesn't exist. There's a reason all the British races struggle. And there's a reason that the Australian races, if they weren't owned and organized by a literal state government, which has a big budget, and then organizes all the policing in South Australia, there's a reason why these races all are able to happen in the traditional cycling countries. And one of those is not just audience interest, it's just the cost of them happening. It's the places... A local Spanish town, when the Vuelta comes to say, hey, we want to sponsor... We want to have our stage finish here, they say, what can we do for you? We'll repaint the roads, redo the roads, put a couple of extra corners in for a crazy finish. We'll let us roll out the red carpet and we'll pay you. In California, it sounded like when you wanted to go through a town, the mayor or whatever was like, that's going to cost X and you're going to have to fill out a million pieces of paperwork. I might be simplifying it, but that's a general theme. Okay, let's draw a bow on that, Benji. The last thing we wanted to talk on was Is this going to be the best 1 week race of the year, the Dauphiné?
Possibly. The route looks good. I'll be honest. 8 stages like always. And there's a time trial in there, 34 kilometers. But obviously, we're looking at the mountain stages mainly. If I'm a sprinter, I'd probably abandon after stage one because there's like one opportunity far towards the end of the week. And the first stage is also a sprint. So if you're Groenewegen and you need to be sent to the Dauphiné again, then I'm looking at a situation where I'd abandon after day one. But looking at the actual mountain stages, the last three are back-to-back mountain stages. And I'll be honest, the third last stage and the last stage are fairly similar, actually, outside of the last climb specifications. And if we look specifically at the last three stages, let's go through it for a second. 173 kilometers, it's got an 11.1 kilometer, 8% climb on day five. Then day six, seven, and eight. Stage seven, we're looking at, I reckon, one of the hardest stages together with the last stage. Like three mountains in the first 60% of the stage. And a first time, I think, we go up the final climb in the history of potentially cycling. Somewhere in 1600 is the climb. 10 kilometers at 9.3%.
That's hard.
That's very really hard. I'm looking forward to that one. I will say that stage specifically looks like it's going to be a final climb event, as in the climbs that come early are too early to make like a launching pad, and the last climb is too hard to be able to risk that, I reckon. But the final stage does have the potential ability for an early launch, as in there's a climb before the final climb that comes with 50k to go, which is the Lissayef climb, 12 kilometers at 7%. And then the final climb is Plateau de Glière. We've seen that in 2020 through the France?
2020, yeah. But this is the other side.
Oh.
They go up the other side, different? Yeah. I don't even know. I just know it's the other side. but they don't do the gravel. They don't do the gravel.
Okay. Yeah.
This is super hard finish. Like, this has got provisional start list Remco, Roglic, Vingegaard. If this is what it is built to be and these guys go hammer and tongs in these last three stages or across the week, and if Remco, especially with that long TT, you know, I'm already mouth-watering waiting for this race before the tour. So pray to God they all get there in good shape because that is going to be a cracker. You know, Samoens reminds me of Solaison. And so the storylines of Vingegaard now against Roglic,
yeah,
like that is going to be an interesting stage. So, yeah, I'm glad they've. Did you say Groenewegen has to abandon? I mean, he can't go this race.
Well, he's been going despite the parkour's not being perfect for sprints in the last few years anyway. Yeah, so maybe he goes to like better his climbing before the Tour de France every year. I think that was the thought behind it.
Brutal race for sprinters. sorry, our last topic was actually the change for Strada Bianca, which I'm going to admit once again, I say this every year, Benji, I don't know what a monument is.
Yeah, correct.
I don't know what that is.
A monument is a subjective term that was created, I reckon, somewhere in the 80s or 90s for the hardest and somewhat older races, the one-day races, the most important ones throughout the season. And we've got five of them. Obviously, if you're watching this podcast, you probably know which ones they are. MSR, Roubaix, RVV, Lombardia, and
Liège.
Don't be mean about it.
Don't seem well on you, Benji, but come on.
Strade is a very controversial topic, whether it should be a monument or not the last few years. People go back and forth on it all the time, and I feel like Strade is trying to make a bit of an argument of trying to become a monument, which is a difficult process if you think about it. They're adding four gravel segments. The race previously was around 200K or just under, if I recall correctly, 184. And they're now adding sector 9 to 12, which is basically, it's not in the first half of the race. Usually the race opens up on Monte Sante Marie, which is like a long gravel section at 130 kilometers into the race. And now we've got four gravel segments that are added after that, which is basically Le Tolfe is now done twice and so forth. So that's what you're looking at when it comes to the stage, which means the race is now 214-ish kilometers. So it's longer, it's harder, it could open up earlier, which I would like to see this. I am curious what's going to happen. Strade has already been very difficult in years where it didn't have that, and maybe now it's even harder. And I think quite a few people are going to be like, oh, it should be a monument. But then the thing is, if you create a monument, or if you, how do you decide something's, is that even an official term?
I don't think so.
I don't know if it's even in the UCI rules.
It is. Well, it is by virtue of the points allocated to them since this year.
Yes, but last year, MSR was the same as Quebec, or 2 years ago.
Yeah, but now they have like a million, they get like 1,000 points. It's like a grand tour now. They changed it. I'm just checking how much climbing is in it now.
Does that make, because like we're talking about all the 1925 winner of MSR. I don't know if the race existed already back then, but he's a monument winner. But the term monument didn't exist yet.
Yeah, I know.
From what I can tell. I think that was after a world war or something that it started showing up the term. But then I'm looking at Strade and I'm like, is Gilbert suddenly a 5 monument winner? Because if Strade becomes a monument?
Yeah, because he won. If it becomes a monument and he won it before.
Mate, Tish is a monument winner then.
Yeah. Stieber.
It's difficult, huh?
I think if you talk about interest or races I'm excited to watch each year, yeah. I want to watch Strade Bianche more than I want to watch Lombardia. Like, that's just a fact. Well, not a fact. Well, it's a fact in my mind that I do. You can't change that fact. I don't like this change, though. I think chasing some sort of, I don't know, the media deciding you're now a monument or that eligibility, why does it matter? You get a fucking good start list every year. It's a great race 80% of the time, I would say. The Pogacar solo one wasn't that great, but they're still happy that Poggy won the race. It's, why are you changing what I think is a winning formula? And the winning formula for this race is, in 2021, you had a group of Egan Bernal, Julian Alaphilippe, Mathieu van der Poel, Wout van Aert, and Quinn Simmons, and Goebel.
Yes.
So you now add more climbing to it, 3,674 meters with two additional four-star sectors. I worry that you then make it so that Cancellara, Stieber, Van Aert and Van der Poel are special beasts, but it makes it harder for those guys and makes it more of a hill, a proper sort of more to the climbers, whereas I think it was perfectly balanced how the route already was.
I would like to see it like this, to be honest. If we take a look at how do we perceive the other classics, let's for example say that last year Strade Parcours is the tree to this RVV setup. Is how I view it. As in, E3 is a shorter version of RVV, kind of.
Yeah.
Which creates other race dynamics.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, but that's what I mean, though. Like, then just
I think this could
the
be
best
more
rider
epic
will win
well.
Every time.
Like, Strade has never had necessarily issues. There's been a few editions where I was like, oh, okay, this was kind of meh. I'll be honest, last year's edition was not the greatest edition of Strade Bianche either. And
I thought it was gripping.
Really?
You didn't think it was exciting, seeing if the group would catch Pidcock? I thought it was exciting.
I think it was enjoyable, but I enjoyed the Van der Poel and Wout van Aert epic editions more.
Yeah, but it's going to have a crack start this year because of the tour having a gravel stage.
I enjoy seeing this change. I don't think it's going to ruin the race. I think it's going to be relatively the same, it's just going to be longer and harder.
Okay. We'll see.
And also,
why
it's
if they said they did it?
What is that term? It's going to divide the lions from the sheep, or what is that term? The wolves from the sheep?
Yeah, the men what from the boys is what people used to say.
Okay.
Chaff from the wheat. Yeah. Oil from water. No, that's already divided. It's insoluble.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, listen, it could be great. I think, you know, a lot of these races as well is are only as good as the start list and the way the race plan pans out anyway. So it, it doesn't necessarily, if you have a bad start list or one rider too dominant, then it doesn't really matter what route you'll have. But it's just interesting to see them doing that, changing it. Maybe they just wanted to make it more epic for the cycle tourists who do the Grand Fondo. Because like what I don't know what monument status would add to them, like financially. Like, yeah, there's more UCI points, but what would it add?
I think there's an image thing to it. I think there's a start list thing to it.
True. So if there's so many points available, then Vanderpool just does it every year in theory.
Not necessarily for the points, but
because to add a monument to the Palmares. If it was a monument, would Wout van Aert do it this year? I don't know if he's...
Yeah, would that be a difference?
I don't know if he's doing it or not, but...
He's not doing it, I think. I think he's doing opening weekend.
If it was a monument, do you think he'd do it? I think he would.
I don't know.
I think he would.
I can tell you. It depends on whether the team sees it as...
No, it's a monument. It's a monument.
If Strade becomes a monument, will teams perceive that as the same level as the other monuments that were before?
For sure.
It's such a difficult concept.
Also, I just remembered, riders in their contracts have monument bonus. They have tiered bonuses, right?
Yeah.
So if you can win a monument, you get a bigger bonus. So it does make a difference. It does. Maybe that's what they're going for. But yeah, let us know what you think about the Strade change. It's still not 250K, so maybe it's not meeting the criteria just yet. Maybe they'll keep adding 15Ks every year till they get to 250. But that's all from us. I believe today we've wrapped up as much cycling news as I could scour across the interwebs and Twitter. We hope you enjoyed the show and the cycling coming up this week. You got one last thought, Benji?
How's your training going?
Oh, my training? Well, yeah, last week not that good because I was toing and froing. Yeah. And I did get a couple of runs in. I did run around the hotel in Den Bosch. Is it Den Bosch or Den Bosch?
It's all the same.
Ooh, Luke's going to be saying in the chat something. He said Den Bosch. But it's got the Bosch Bosch appliances, Luke, is spelt the same. B-O-S-C-H is Bosch. So why would it be Den Bosch? Think about it. I went for a run. It was pretty good. Like flat, so that was sweet. But I only had my Australian running gear, so my nips and my ears got so cold. But we, you know, I'm a brave boy. You can go and see. I put a vlog up of that actually today, this afternoon.
Honestly, on my end, I went into panic mode after you mentioned last year that was a day of 190 kilometers in there because.
Yeah, 190 ain't no joke.
I had heard of the Flandrian challenge. I didn't know it was 410 kilometers in 3 days. One day, 75 kilometers, then 190, then 140, 145, with 59 cobblebergs and cobble segments and bergs in it. Like, I don't even know if I can do the endurance of the entire 190K. So I started my plan directly after the podcast last week. I immediately went into training mode. I've trained 8 hours and a half this week. That's my heaviest training week of my entire life.
Good.
January was my biggest month of my entire life on the bike. And that's the lowest amount of hours I'll have in the next 6 weeks. Because I have to gradually up the hours every day. It's going to be a bit difficult the next week because I need to go to the Tour Vantalia race. But I'm going to be doing 10 to 15 hours a week now as preparation. So hopefully that helps me able to finish. I'll be honest, I think there's going to be numerous occasions where you'll have to wait on me. But that's the least of my worries. I just want to finish.
Oh, it's long for me as well. That's why I was tossing and throwing between the join plan. Like, do I do the stamina plan? Just do the stamina plan. And like, because the classics plan, it will have me doing some anaerobic work. But really, I'm not trying to race it. I'm trying to get through the 3 days. So that's what I was. But the thing is, I'll have so much availability that I think with the classics plan, I'll be doing so much aerobic endurance that I think it's probably the right thing to do anyway, but that's what I'm debating.
And for me, it's intriguing because it's not just endurance for me. It's also, I will need to be able to do the
you got to spike your watts.
Two 7 minute what's to be able to get over these climbs, because I'll be running out of gears most likely on the very steep climbs.
We'll get you on with a good rear derailleur.
Yeah, I think I'll need a very good one-to-one gearing or something crazy or one by or something.
Well, I haven't mentally processed is if it's bad weather. I can't do 190Ks in the rain.
Oh, I would love bad weather.
I can't do it. I'll
see
die.
You suffer.
Dude. I'll literally
we're doing
just...
it, even if it fucking snows, man.
I would no extreme. I will call Adam Hansen and get him to explain to you that I do not ride in the snow or any light drizzle. So no, I'll call him and he won't answer because I'm always being mean.
I'm also terrified, not of the climbing and the length. Like I'll just ride and see where I finish. I want to finish in my head, but we'll see what happens. But I'm terrified of the descents. Cobble descending is included, right?
I'd say so. And if it's raining, I mean, I don't know what. Yeah, that's not going to be that. So we got things to think about, Benji. We really got to get our act together.
Ouch.
And Mrs. Rouge returns tomorrow.
Why are we doing this?
Because it's going to be funny. And because it actually makes us get our ass into gear. So that's two reasons why we're going to do it. But yeah, hope you all enjoyed this episode. And we'll see you with maybe something this week. If not, we'll see you with the next edition of the Weekly Show next Monday. Till then, ciao.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.